Welcome to another edition of the Basketball Teacher Podcast. Our mission is to bring you discussions on a wide array of topics in the coaching world to grow players on and off the court. You can connect with us on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, and also reach us directly through email at basketballteacherpodcast@gmail.com. Now, here's your host, Coach Mike Hernandez.
Welcome back, everyone. Thank you guys so much for joining us on whatever platform you're listening to us on. I know I say it every single episode, but thank you so much for your continued support. And I really appreciate all the kind messages that you have sent my way as well. So today's episode, we are getting into offense, specifically into ball screen continuity offense. And I think that this is such a great topic because a lot of coaches talk about getting more ball screen action in their offense, getting more continuity in their offense, getting opportunities for their players to make decisions and make the right reads. And so it's very topical. And that's why I wanted to spend today's episode just talking about this sort of offense, what it looks like, how to implement it, how to refine it, all that sort of good stuff, so that either you may think about using it yourself, or if you already use this type of offense, that you can maybe get some little tips and tricks to maybe make some adjustments to it. So this is going to be a good one. My guest today is one who runs this offense, is going to talk about their experience with it and share their expertise with it. I'm very happy to be joined by head girls basketball coach at All Saints Episcopal School, Coach David Sanders. Coach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Just getting ready for summer. Excited to end school here in a couple days and head into our summer. So doing well.
Yeah, I always say that summer is one of the most exciting times. You know, it's a real great opportunity for not only basketball, but for bonding and all that, in a more kind of casual-ish type setting than the grind of a regular season. I love summer as well. So right there with you. Alrighty, Coach. So let's go ahead and start with your journey. Where has the game of basketball taken you? Where's your coaching journey taken you? And how have you ended up where you are currently at right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have a pretty simple background in basketball. Obviously grew up playing and was a player and a decent high school player in Texas at a 4A high school, and had the chance to go play my freshman year at a little private Christian school in Louisiana called Louisiana College, a Division III school. Only made it my freshman year, didn't like it, and so played my freshman year and went back to the local college in Southeast Texas, which is Lamar University, which is a Division I school, and got my undergrad in kinesiology there. But while there, kind of fell back into the game and started student coaching when I was 19 years old at a local high school that my high school JV coach became the head coach at. And the way they did that was I became a full-time school bus driver at the age of 19. So here I am at 19, taking a full load of classes at college, driving school routes in the morning, driving afternoon routes, staying for practice, staying for games. And I coached just about every sport that I possibly could. And did that for 2 years, absolutely loved it. And then kind of fell into an opportunity to be a grad assistant men's basketball coach at Northwestern State University in Natchitoches, Louisiana, also Division I school. They're most probably famous for in 2006, they beat Iowa in March Madness in the first round on a buzzer beater. And then went on to lose to West Virginia in the next round, but it's one of the most iconic March Madness shots, gets shown all the time. And so that program has been really successful under the head coach there, Mike McConathy. He's been there 20 years and has been to three NCAA tournaments and has won a couple games there in the tournament and just been overall successful. Actually now is the most successful or has the most wins in college basketball history in Louisiana. So,
oh wow,
just a great guy and a heck of a coach. And so it was at Northwestern State as a GA that I really fell in love with the ball screen offense. He is notorious for running what's called the Buna power offense, but basically it's a top of the key roll and replace ball screen offense is what he has kind of built his success on. And so that's where I fell in love with ball screen offenses. And then from there, in my own coaching journey, came upon the offense that I mainly use now. But after that, was kind of in and out of coaching for different reasons, mostly because I was moving a lot because I met my wife at Northwestern State and she was a soccer coach. And so we kind of followed her career for a little bit. But as far as being a head coach, I spent 3 years at a two-way school, public school here at, in Northeast Texas called New Summerfield. That was my first head coaching job. Great opportunity because it had no football. And so basketball was king. And they had some success before. We built a brand new gym while I was there. Basically had my boys year around, you know, for better or worse. And then, but we lived in Tyler because my wife is from Tyler. And after we had our third kid, we have three kids. After we had our third, it was time to just get closer home because it was about a 45-minute drive each way. And so that's how I ended up here at All Saints Episcopal School in Tyler as the girls coach. I knew the boys, the former boys coach and now athletic director, Eddie Francis, and knew him just through being local and all that kind of stuff. And so just finished up my second year here at All Saints. So in total, I have 5 years of being a head coach. So,
and in my research about your school, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be a very small school in terms of like the student population. Am I correct in that? Did I do my research correctly? Is it a small school?
It is. It's actually a tiny bit bigger than New Summerfield where I was at. At New Summerfield, our high school had about 145 kids. Here at All Saints, our high school has about 160 kids total. Yeah.
So I have to ask, because for me, that is a huge, huge difference from any of the schools I've ever been at. And I'm sure for a lot of coaches that might be almost unheard of to work at a school of that small. So I want to ask you about working in an environment with a small school population. What sort of unique situations do you feel like you find yourself in by being at a smaller school versus one that maybe have, you know, thousands of high schools enrolled in it?
For sure. It's unique. And really, specifically here in Northeast Texas, you have some really strong, dominant small school programs. All Saints at this point is not one of those schools, but it can be done, and it can be, we're trying to make it that way. It can be done, and a lot of people love basketball here. Obviously in Texas, football is king, and so a lot of schools are built around football, but the unique aspect of being at some smaller schools that I've been at, again, New Summerfield didn't have football, and so I had I had 30 something kids in my basketball program, which for a two-way, a small school, was not bad numbers.
Sure.
My first year I had three teams, and in that level, typically two-way schools don't have a freshman team and a JV and a varsity. Now that wasn't every single year that I was there, but I did have it my first year. And so I've really been, as far as small schools, I've been on each side of the spectrum. I've had a New Summerfield where I almost had too many kids. And I don't know if you can ever have too many.
Right. Is that, yeah.
There's a couple I had conversations with like, hey, it may be best that you go contribute in baseball. You know, if you want to keep playing basketball, please come on. But I'm just kind of painting the picture for you. Where here at All Saints, my first year at All Saints, I had 12 girls total in my high school play. And this past season, I had 11. And so I've really been on the two sides, opposite sides of one school. I didn't ever worried about having enough kids to play. I didn't have to go walk the hallways and ask kids to play basketball or would they come out and give it a try. Here at All Saints, specifically on the girls' side, I've had to do that. Each year, I've had to recruit girls on campus to come out and play. because it's just never been a huge program as far as numbers.
Sure, but, especially if you're building something.
Yeah, and it's, you know, here, a lot of the girls play volleyball. And so I've got to convince them, especially the better athletes, hey, you can play volleyball and basketball, right? Mm-hmm. You can come contribute to basketball just like you're contributing to other sports on campus. And so that is a challenge. And it's something that we talk about almost on a daily basis. How can we grow this program to where, you know, you have 16, 18, 20 girls in it, and now you have a JV team, and now you're not asking freshmen to come and play varsity basketball, you know, when they don't necessarily need to or should. And so it's a problem. It's a unique problem, but we're trying to change it.
Yeah, I think that there's so many unique experiences just in that sort of environment, like you said, with you could have running three teams in a small school, or I've seen 6A schools that can't even field three teams. And then, you know, you have the other situations as well, where especially if you, like you said, you're trying to build something, and I've been there before where you're just trying to get something going. But hopefully once it does get going and as the years go on, then it'll just sort of sustain itself and you'll be off and running with that. So really cool.
I think what you really have to do from just my, again, short-term experience here at this specific school, and this is what we're trying to do, is you got to start at the lower grades, and you invest as much time as you possibly can in that third, fourth, fifth grade range. Here we're all on one campus here. We're not on separate campuses. So I can, if I'm able to in my class schedule, if I can go to a fourth or fifth grade PE class and do some basketball skills with them here or there. If we can get those girls to come to our summer camp, if we can get them playing in some local youth league, you know, that's how you get them to tie into each other and buy in. And then as they get to middle school and then up to the high school level, there's hopefully more that want to play and want to continue playing.
Yeah.
Because our middle school will have decent numbers. It's the transition from middle school to high school. It's been in the history that's where a lot of the girls kind of start dropping off and say, okay, I just want to do volleyball. Tennis is very successful here at All Saints. So they may move to tennis. They, you know, soccer, there's different, we offer a lot of sports, obviously.
Yeah.
So it's trying to get them to stay attached to basketball all the way through high school.
Yeah. So sometimes that's a challenge in and of itself when your school has renowned for other sports and is well known for other sports. You got to fight your way in there if you're trying to build a program for sure. Awesome, Coach. So I know a lot of coaches listening run some form of a continuity offense and integrate ball screens and have maybe their own variation or spin on it. And I know that this is an audio-based podcast, so there are certain limitations in terms of the visual element here, but can you walk us through your offense and what looks you're trying to get? And also, why do you believe in running the system that you do offensively?
Yeah, I guess first I'll start with why. Mm-hmm. I think we copy a lot of things from the highest level of basketball, obviously, and it kind of trickles down right from the NBA down to, hang on, podcast. That's my AD and basketball legend. It just popped in. I didn't invent this, obviously. And so, if the NBA exclusively runs ball screens a ton, and now there's just a little bit more isolation based, I think, just because the talent level of those guys is, you know, just crazy. But it trickles down into college, or from overseas in college down into high school. I like ball screens because it can create some advantages. And I think that's important at the high school level. And then can you take advantage of those mismatches that ball screens tend to produce? And so, and then also, I'm just even thinking as me as a coach, I don't spend a ton of time going over all our ball screen coverage. You know, I'm not dedicating 20, 30 minutes to going over ball screens. Now, I have a pretty simple philosophy on ball screens. We either switch or trap. I just make, I keep it real simple, right? We don't do a whole bunch of hedging or icing or anything complicated, but that's one reason I think it creates advantages, and it puts your players in advantage positions. And so the second reason is I think you can drill it. I really like things that are, that you can drill 1-on-0, 2-on-0, 2-on-2, do some small-sided type games with that offense or with that type of shot or passes that you're looking for. And then you take all that work and drill work, and now you put it into live play. Mm-hmm. And I really like that type of stuff. And then it gives the players some freedom, right? And you have to teach them those reads. You have to teach them what to look for, what things are most common, what are going to be the best, you know, ideal solutions. But then there's freedom within that as a player to make plays and make adjustments. And that's what I love about it. And that's what I loved about, as I mentioned earlier, at Northwestern State, the power. Power is very, very simple. It is not complicated at all. Neither is this offense at all. But it gives the player freedom to make adjustments and play. And at the end of the day, as a high school coach, one of the things that I value the most is I just want my players to learn how to play basketball. I don't want them to be so robotic and so structured that they can't think for themselves. I want to put them in positions and say, here are a couple of things to think about. Now go do it and go adjust and make decisions on the fly. Mm-hmm. And hopefully through those drills, it teaches them how to do that with confidence and with success.
So when you're setting up your offense, and I know that one of the advantages of your offense is that there are a lot of different reads, there's a lot of different looks, there's a lot of freedom in a sense in terms of the decision-making process that your players have in it. But let's just say in an ideal situation, you know, the world is perfect and you're going to run this offense the exact way that you're hoping to run it to get the best look possible. What would that sort of look like on the court?
It would really, I'm definitely a fast break guy. And so the goal is for it to be a seamless transition in your break. I still love rim runners. I myself was a forward. And so I selfishly kind of cater things to forwards, I think. I think I'm partial to their skill set. I still like for the ball to go in the post. And so we do rim runner. We're not totally – it's almost a five-out offense, but it's not at the same time. And there's some adjustments you can make to mess with that. But my ideal situation is to flow it right into it from a fast break to where there's never any pause. How you get into it can be done by a couple – or really as many different ways as you want it to be done. But the goal is obviously to get the ball up the floor and then to have the ball switch sides of the floor as much as possible too. And that's one thing you really have to teach kids on the first ball screen, the first side ball screen, because that's basically what it is. It's a two-man game. So you have a side ball screen on one side of the floor, and then you have three players spaced out on the other side of the floor. And then the continuity part is it gets reversed across the midline up to the what I call the slot, the NBA slot or the lane line that extends all the way up the court. And then it continues on to the other side. And then you do the same thing, right? And then that's the continuity part. And so rarely do you ever score off of that first ball screen. That first ball screen is just to kind of get the defense – moving from side to side and make them be honest.
Sure.
The scoring opportunities for the most part come after the second or third ball screen. So really the goal is to get the ball swinging from side to side. Rarely do you score in that first ball screen. Your most aggressive scoring opportunities come on the second or third ball screen of the continuity part. And so it's teaching players to, hey, be aggressive on that first ball screen. But at the same time, know that the defense is set and prepared for that first ball screen. Get that ball swinging from side to side. You'll have another opportunity to get those same type of looks. And so what I really enjoy about this offense, and again, for descriptor sake, Gonzaga used it for a handful of years and still does. If you look on YouTube, it's probably labeled as the most used offense in college basketball. So this is nothing new. It's been around 3 or 4 years probably. I call it the European ball screen offense. My name for it is Dose. I chose Dose because my first school, New Summerfield, is largely Hispanic. And so I came up with Dose because it's a two-man game. And so I just called it Dose. And I've kept that, and I just like it, and it kind of describes what it is. But what I really like is how you can be creative. And again, you can keep it simple, which I love to do. I'm not about trying to overload my players with too much information or too many sets or how to get into it or too many calls. You can get into it so many different ways. So if you love quick hitters, you can definitely design quick hitters that flow right into the offense.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I kind of like about it is that there's – you know, if you're looking for a specific look and you know that there's something to exploit, you know, there's so many options available to you that you almost can read what the defense is doing and, you know, decide like if you want to drive and kick or if, you know, there's plenty of different options with it. Just I think that's kind of the beauty of it is how many different looks you can kind of get out of that ball screen or going through it a few times. And that actually leads to a question that I have. This is kind of one personal to me, but I'm sure others listening probably have this as well, is when players kind of get stuck feeling like there's just a certain look that they are best at and they try to kind of force that look, maybe it's a certain drive or they want to use a certain screen or they want to, you know, be the person that gets kicked out to hit a three. How do you sort of break that up where players are making the right decision based on what the defense is doing rather than trying to force like one specific action for themselves?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think as a coach, you kind of have to decide what players can and cannot do. And I'll give you an example of that. I had a kid in my previous school that the best spot up shooter on my team. And he could let it fly, and that was his strength. But I didn't want him coming off a ball screen and having the ball in his hands.
Sure.
He's just not a playmaker, right? And so there's a couple adjustments you can do with that. Now, or you just tell the kid, hey, you come off the ball screen, and your job is to be – your job is to reverse it, right? You're not really trying to make a play off the dribble. You're not trying to get to the kill spot, which is, you know, a term I stole from like dribble drive, trying to get to the elbow, right?
Right.
Your main job is to get the ball out of your hands and reverse it so someone else can come along and use a ball screen and get into the kill spot and then kick it out to you for the shot. But he wasn't very big. So a lot of times his most success, in my opinion, came when I put him at a forward spot as a reversal man, because it did two things. One, it means he didn't have to really dribble a whole lot. Two, the defender had to be honest. They could sink in on the ball screen, but then you're going to leave our best shooter, Allen Perimeter, wide open for a slot or a top of the key wide open three. Which he's definitely capable of hitting. And then on the pick and roll too, I told him, you never roll. You're never rolling to the rim. You're going to pop every single time. And so, again, finding out and knowing your player's strengths and weaknesses, you can definitely cater to it. My best player at that previous school was a 6'4 kid who walked on at a Division II school, scored over 1,700 points in his high school career. It took me a year to figure out, like, I need to get the ball in his hands every single play. And he was skilled enough to dribble it up the court and kind of run the show. but he was also just a big kid, 6'4", 200 pounds, that I wanted to get the ball in the post to him too. So I let him do both, right? You know, I let him be the point guard and come off a ball screen, and he was left-handed. So if he was on the right side, he could come off that ball screen, and now he's driving in there with his left hand and has a great chance to be successful. Or if I put him as a screener, we had special sets to where, hey, person coming off the ball screen, you better find him because he's rolling. And if you don't find him, then he's going to seal, and then you have an opportunity for a good post-up. And so it's finding those strengths of your players. But what I like about it, I mean, my other post, I didn't want him to dribble ever, you know, and he never came outside the three-point line to shoot. And so his job was, hey, if after you pass it and reverse it, sprint to the ball screen and then dive to the rim every single time. That is your job. And then your other job is when the ball is shot, you're crashing the boards and try to go get offensive rebound. Those are your two main jobs on offense that I want you to be about. So that's what I really like about this offense is you can cater it specifically to the type of kids that you have.
I think that that's kind of a bit of a balancing act for a coach to have. And this is perhaps something that you've been through as well, where you want your players to be the ones, you know, making the decisions, reading the defense and deciding what's best and the best course of action. But as you mentioned, there are certain actions that you want either players to always be doing, or perhaps for players to never be doing. And as a coach, do you have to, I guess, tell your players like, hey, if we get this, you know, certain, you know, action happening, like we should always be going to this no matter what, or do you kind of let them have to kind of figure it out themselves? How do you kind of balance, I guess, the act of, you know, here's the situation that we're going to put the players in to be successful versus, you know, this is a specific situation that, you know, I as a coach want to happen because I know that we can be successful if we do this specific action.
Yeah, I think it is a good mix. My natural inclination is to let them figure it out. Mm-hmm. And then if I need a guaranteed bucket or a really great chance at a bucket, I'm going to call a certain play where they're looking for that specific player. And
there's a certain signal or something that you specifically call out for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so here is something that's simple and I'll draw it for you, even though everyone else can't see it. It's really simple, but it worked quite a bit on the ball screen. My best player, when I put him as a forward, he'd go set the ball screen. And so when he dives to the block, the person coming off the ball screen is getting to the kill spot at the elbow. But his whole intention is not to reverse the ball to the opposite forward to continue the continuity part. Mm-hmm. It was special because he stopped at the elbow and pivoted around and then just did a quick post feed right there on the same side of the block. And now my best player has got it one-on-one on the block with no help. And I can't tell you how many times that simple little play worked. And I just called it special. And so when we needed the ball to go on the block because he was a special player, I called it special. I was like, give the ball to him. And then the handful of times that when he would score, if they doubled down, now the person who threw him the pass is just kind of relocating out to the three, and now he could kick it out for the passer to have like a relocate 3-point shot. But things like that are very simple. My second best player was a guard who was pretty good and he could score. And so I had sets for him to come off of a single pin down through this offense or even a double staggered to get him coming off of some screens to get a catch and shoot three or a chance for a catch and drive. And so, but for the most part, I think it was, my first year that I ran this, I didn't do a great job of teaching it. I didn't truly understand or just because it was my first year as a head coach, just didn't spend enough time diving into the intricacies of it.
Yeah.
But by year three, and now I've had these kids 3 years with me, they knew exactly what to look for. And that's just through repetition. It's through drills. It's through understanding what each one of them as individual players have the ability to do. But it does take some time. But my natural inclination is to tell the players, hey, here's what we're looking for. In general, I want you to make those plays, whatever that looks like. If we need to call up something specific, then, you know, I'll make sure that you know what you're doing.
And I think in an ideal world, that's something that all coaches would love, to be able to have the players be able to know what the right read is and make the correct decision. But building that can be difficult. Building your players' decision-making ability and their ability to read the defense can be tricky. I know that from firsthand experience. So I wanted to ask you about what are some ways to, as best as possible, authentically replicate kind of like game-like situations where your players are building upon their decision-making, you know, whether it's through drills or through certain things that you do in practice?
Yeah, I think the most basic is you put them in the positions of this offense. And so you, I'm a big believer in the whole part, whole method. And so, you know, you kind of show them the whole thing first, and now your drills. Now you're going to do like 1-on-0 or 2-on-0 drilling. And now player coming off the wing ball screen, your goal is to get to the kill spot as fast as you can and as little as dribble as you can. And now here are your options once you get there, right? So it may be a drive all the way to the bucket. It may be kind of like what I call a stop and pop, like a little half floater type shot. It may be an elbow jumper. It may be your man went under the screen and now you got to pull up for a three-pointer. In this offense, rejecting the screen, and every time you reject the screen, going to the baseline is a great option, right? That's how you keep that defender honest and can get some good looks. So you look there too. And then you also look at the types of passes that they have to make. So it may be a little floater pass. It may be a pocket, a true pocket pass. It may be a little jump hook type of pass. Again, you drill all those 1-on-0 or 2-on-0. And then obviously add some type of defenders. And so that's the basic level. Yep. What I've become really convinced of is doing drills that give advantages or disadvantages to the offensive player. So I do a lot of drills to where it's 1-on-1, excuse me, but I'll give the offensive player an advantage and say, okay, offensive player, here's your advantage. Now go score. And then you can add another player or another two players and say, now, okay, you have the advantage. So you're kind of taking the concept of, okay, you got past the ball screen or you got past your defender, but now there's a next level, right, of decision-making that you got to make. Because – in a game, most likely, you're going to have a second-level defender step up and make you make some type of decision.
Yeah.
And so my ultimate goal, and I tell my players this all the time, is for them to become 3D players. I would say right now most of my girls here at this particular school are 1D, right? They're on that very basic level.
Sure.
And I just want them to learn – some of the basics and the fundamentals of what I'm trying to teach them. This past season, we were able to get most of the girls to what I call a 2D level player, where they're, okay, you've got the basic skill down. Now, here comes your second level decision-making that you got to learn how to make. And then obviously within that, the next step is to make 3D level players to where they're seeing things before it happens, and then they know and they're confident in their skill set where they can make adjustments on the fly. I tell my players all the time, that's what I love about basketball, mm-hmm. is rarely is something done the same like twice in a row, right? There's going to be some little nuance that's a little bit different. And so that's why it always keeps you guessing, right? It keeps you making decisions. And so I try to come up with drills, find drills online, podcasts, reading, whatever, to where, how can I help them make decisions quicker and make the right decisions?
And I think that
more success.
One of the things that is tricky, which you kind of mentioned, is the fact that not all players' decision-making ability is going to be equal. And on the court, you're going to have in game-like situations where some people's ability to read the defense is way up here, while others are, you know, just kind of need things more mechanical and things more broken down. And is that something that you have to kind of take into consideration, like when you're, you know, game planning or doing your strategies? Like, okay, on offense, I know, you know, player X and Y are able to, you know, make all these different reads, while, you know, certain players, like, you're just not there yet. So I just need you to focus on doing like these certain actions. Is that something you kind of have to go through?
Oh, for sure. And here at All Saints, it's this specifically this last year, it was just drastic difference, right? And you take what you can get, but I would consider probably my 1B as far as top ranked player was a post player. She was pretty good, comes from a basketball family, has really good IQ and knowledge. So I was confident that when the ball went in her hand, she's going to find the right play. Mm-hmm. She's going to find the right decision. And oftentimes I had to ask her to try to score more because she was wanting to pass it, but she had the ability to pass it. Like, she rarely made a bad decision. But I wanted her to use her size. She was a 6-foot girl. I wanted her to use her size to be aggressive and go score, because there's just not many of those type of girls at our level around. Contrast to, she was a senior. Contrast to another senior who came out and played basketball for the first time this year since sixth grade. Had been a soccer player. Was really athletic. Great work ethic. Great attitude. But she hadn't played basketball, organized basketball, since sixth grade. And so, obviously, the difference between them two and trying to teach them, I gave this former soccer player, Sarah, I tried to give her a lot less responsibilities than I gave Shelby. And that's just natural, because Sarah could have all the best intentions in the world to want to do that. But if she doesn't have the know-all or the wherewithal and experience of basketball to know how to do it and be successful, then that's just not very smart on my part. And so,
And real quick,
just because of her effort.
Yeah. Real quick before I forget, and this is something that you can add on to, I think one of the things to also consider when you have situations like that is that you might have players whose vision and whose like ability to read defensive and make decisions is so up high compared to other players that that player might make the right decision, but the other players might not even have seen it or be ready for it. And all of a sudden that puts them in a bad situation where that player with really great vision is able to make this pass because they see that it's there, but the player wasn't at all expecting it. And all of a sudden you get a turnover somehow that way too. I know I've been there as well.
Yeah, it happens quite a bit. In that, you know, when you have a drastic, because I would say really my top two players, the difference between my top two players and my bottom two players was drastic. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, like, just two of them were seniors and played a lot of basketball. The other two were freshmen who have not played a bunch of basketball. And just even those freshmen, their skill level is relatively low. So, you know, just trying to bridge those things together, it can be complicated and difficult, and you got to find a way to put your best players in the position to be most successful while also teaching your younger, inexperienced players how they can be successful too, and how they can contribute. And it's a tricky thing, and I didn't always get it right, but you try.
Yeah. And I do think there's something to be said for, you know, your less experienced players who may not have a lot of knowledge, like reading the court, to be like, okay, you just got to focus on doing this and this. And it may look a little mechanical at first, but I think that knowledge will build especially with experience. And then you kind of hopefully can kind of build up. And as you said earlier, like now you're, I think, in the position, right, where this you've had some of these girls for a few years. So you probably took some lumps there in the beginning trying to build up that decision making. But now I'm sure if you look back, you're like, okay, they've definitely come a long way in a few years.
No, we did. Actually, it's funny you say that because I'm about to restart again. And so out of my 11 players I had this year, I had eight seniors. And so I'm only returning three girls who played high school basketball last year. And those three girls were my bottom three players. And then I'm moving up, you know, potentially five or six freshmen that played last year. So we're going to, it's going to be a completely new experience.
Back to teaching.
Yeah. I told my AD and boss, I said, hey, if we reach double digit wins next year, I better be state coach of the year, because you know, I think altogether my returning points for next year adds up to like 1 point a game. And so it's going to be interesting, but it's a challenge. Sure. I think I go back and forth with it. You know, sometimes I get excited and think like, this is going to make me a better coach. And sometimes I get depressed and say like, how are we going to score 10 points? But ultimately I think it's going to make me a better coach, you know, yeah, and you may not see the wins and the wins results this year, but if I can get these girls to buy in and over these next couple of years, and we have a good middle school group coming up as far that's got some girls that like to play basketball, we might look up in 3-4 years and be pretty competitive. These next year or two, we're probably not, but hopefully in the end, it just makes me a better coach.
Right. No, for sure. And I think that, like I said, it's a lot, especially in the beginning, but then once they start to get the hang of it, I think they start to make those leaps, bigger and bigger leaps, the more that their knowledge kind of comes into its own and the more that they get familiar with all the decision-making and all the different elements involved in kind of his ball screens and continuity, for sure. Speaking of all those elements, I think that for me personally, one of the challenges is having those efficient practices where if you're running an offense like you are, where, you know, you have ball screening elements, elements of players who have to do strong cuts, you have to have correct spacing, maybe, you know, there's dribble drive elements and good kickouts and being ready to, you know, square up and shoot. With all these different elements, I always feel that coaches never feel that their players are like good enough at all those individual pieces. So I wanted to ask you in terms of like your practice planning and building on those like sort of individual like skills, what does that sort of look like in your practice planning, where you're working on those things but also doing it in an efficient manner so you're not doing like a 12-hour practice?
Yeah, and I'm really big on I hate being in the gym wasting time, and so typically most of my practices are about an hour and a half. Maybe at the very beginning of the season, I might go to 2 hours. But my goal is to get out of there an hour and a half, an hour and 40, 45 minutes tops. And so when I'm planning and designing a practice, I'm very big on skill development, and I have to be, especially, with not a lot of experience and just skill overall, but I want to do so in a way that gets them lots of reps. And so I'm always trying to come up with ways to, how can we get more shots? How can they practice the things that we want them to learn as often as possible? It's kind of just reps on reps on reps. And then adding within that some live play, because you definitely got to have some live play for them to truly see what is going on, and for hopefully them to pick it up a little bit quicker. I'll be honest, I don't spend a ton of time on defense. I am more worried about, especially at my level here, I don't care what kind of defense you run, if you have a hard time getting the ball past half court, it's hard to play defense running from behind someone when they stole it from you at half court.
Turns into a track meet where you're just always running back. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Not that I don't ever practice defense, because we do. But I would say 85-90% of my practice is offensive based. And so it is a fine line of doing things repetitious, because repetition is great, obviously, but beneficial and effective. I've been lucky enough my 5 years as a head coach, when I was a boys coach, I had a guy that I fully trusted. I could say, hey, you go take the guards, and here's what we're doing today. Here are the shots I want you to practice today with the guards. And then me being a forward center myself, I take the bigs, and, you know, I get to work with them. It's the same thing here at All Saints. My assistant, even though she's part-time, was a very, very good basketball player in high school. Mm-hmm. And has a lot of knowledge of the game, was very successful at the high school level as a player, and she's a guard. So I feel very comfortable with saying, guards, you're going to go with Coach Brunson, and you're going to work on these shots, and these are the things I want you to work on. And so I try to split us up, right, so everyone gets a lot of reps, and then try to bring us together too, so where they can work off and feel off of each other.
Yeah. I really like what you mentioned about, you know, trying to have that hour and a half to have that most efficient practice, because I think it's really important to make sure that your players are staying with you that whole time, and, you know, making sure that you're really maximizing the things that are most important to you. And like you said, if defense isn't something that you're going to, you know, maybe focus on as much, then you want to make sure you get the most efficiency out of the offense that you're doing in practice, for sure.
Yeah. And you know, again, in my position, and I may not, if I was in a different circumstance, I definitely did more defense at my previous school. But here, because I'm trying to get girls to play, what is going to get girls to come out and play? Mm-hmm. Are you going to, if you walk up and down the hallways and say, hey, I really think you can play basketball and contribute to us. But by the way, our practices are over 2 hours long, and for an hour, you're going to be working on defense and you won't even touch a basketball. Right. Or is that going to get them to play? Or do you get them to come out and say, hey, guess what? We're going to shoot a lot. And we're going to do skills, and you're going to be on offense a lot, and we're going to play in scrimmage a lot. I'm going to encourage you to shoot the ball. I don't care if it goes in. I want you to shoot it. You know, I think when you're in a position like me, when you need numbers, what's more attractive for kids to play than to say, hey, come shoot the basketball.
Sure. Right?
That's what everyone wants to do. And so I might spend some more time on defense if I was in a different scenario, a different situation, because I'm like any other coach. Defense, I know, wins a lot of games, or it can help you win a lot of games. But when you just want kids to come out and play and have a good time first, and hopefully see some success from that, mm-hmm. then I'm going to spend majority of my time on offense.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that you're, in a way, especially if you're building a program, you're kind of a salesperson as well. You're kind of marketing as well, and you got to kind of build and drum up the excitement and enthusiasm. And offense is certainly a good way to do that, pitching on that. Speaking of those individual elements that I just kind of mentioned and talking about them in the practice setting, for coaches who are maybe looking to implement some sort of continuity offense like the one that we've been discussing, on those individual pieces that, like I mentioned before, about whether it's ball screens, about cutting, spacing, dribble drive action, things of that nature, for any coaches who are looking to, you know, really go all in and implement this sort of offense, in your experience, what pieces do you think a new coach to this will be spending a lot of time on, or maybe might need to spend more time on perfecting than maybe they would expect going in?
That's a great question. I think the number one thing I wrote down was just not being robots, you know, and getting kids to realize at the end of the day, you're still playing basketball. And so play basketball first. Right. And so getting them to learn those reads, like I talk about, we spend a lot of time on that. The spacing, that does take some time, but I think, you know, I'm big on marking little spots on the floor, and you just remind them, hey, these are, and I did it on my board back here, these are the spots that you should be pretty much all the time. And so when they're not, you can easily point it out to them. Timing, I really think timing comes with experience in playing and putting a defense out there to understand what that timing looks like. But I would say the most time I've spent when teaching this offense is how to play within it, and then how to play, like we've talked about before, how to play to your strengths as an individual player within the confines of what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And not doing something that you're not going to be successful at. And so, again, if you have a big that has no business shooting three-pointers, right? Like, if that is, it's not something in their skill set, if they pop after a pick and roll, you say, no, you never pop. You roll to the rim every single time. Mm-hmm. You're looking to get a post seal. You're looking to get a pass off of your ball screen. Again, as a former forward who set plenty of ball screens in my days, I tell them all the time, if you want to get a shot, be a great screener, right? And so give them something to concentrate on. If I want the ball, I'm going to get my teammate open, so it forces my defender to help on him, which then hopefully leaves me open. And so give them things like that, right? Again, teach them how to play rather than, hey, just do this, reverse here, go set a ball screen, roll just to roll, reverse the ball, all that type of stuff. I think that's what you have to teach them the most.
Yeah, I remember seeing games where there would be that like prototypical football player, and they would just set ball screens and they'd roll. I don't know if they ever touched the ball, but that's just what they did. And then they just hit screens, and that was their role. And they were good at that. And that was the strength that they had. And maybe they get a couple touches in the post, but I was like, all I see is them just hitting screens every time. But if that was the skill set that player contributed, then, you know, it makes no sense to put them on the perimeter asking them to shoot or something like that, if that's not going to be the best position for them.
That girl I was telling you about who was a soccer player, that's what made her effective. She didn't hit very many shots for the entire season. She hit a few. The most shots she made, obviously, were layups or layups off of a fast break, just because she would run harder than anybody else.
Yeah.
Get the ball and have a chance to make a breakaway layup. Or she was in the right spot because she did what she had been, you know, coached to do and didn't try to add on to it. And then she would just be there. And now she's there for an offensive rebound because she's where she's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And those players, especially at the high school level, again, and being at a small school, you've got to be able to plug those players in and have them contribute somehow. If not, how do you get those players to come out and play for you, right? The worst thing I can do in my position is ask a girl to come out and play. Hey, we really need you. We're low on numbers. You have an opportunity to play, and then they never play. And you say, well, I'm justified them not playing because they don't really know how to play. Well, obviously they don't, because they haven't been playing for a while. And so you've got to, as a coach, you got to find a way that they can contribute. And then maybe other girls will see, like, oh, she played and she did well or had some success and enjoyed it and had fun. Well, maybe I can do that too, right? And you got to put them in position to be successful. Mm-hmm. And that's, for my 2 years here, no matter how long I'm here, that's what I'm going to walk away with, is having a better understanding of how to do that.
Yeah, I really think that's so important if you're in a environment where you're trying to build a program or you're worried about numbers and you have to, and in a sense, like you almost are like a talent evaluator, where you have to look at a player and be like, all right, like I know you haven't played in a while, or I know you're not necessarily a complete player, but I know you can be successful at this. And as a coach, I mean, that's something that if you have that sort of skill and you can kind of maximize where a player is going to be most efficient and best at, while they're building up on their other skills. I mean, I think that that's like the best way to have your head held high, kind of like you mentioned, is that you put them in a position where you knew they were going to be successful. But that also, and you can speak to this, does require a lot of patience on your end, knowing that, you know, this player might have this, you know, 20 footer that's like, man, they're wide open, but you know, like, and they probably can't make it. And you just sort of have to, in a sense, as best you can, be okay with something like that too.
Yeah, I love, and I tried to implement this as much as I could this year. And I did a podcast earlier about our style of play, the system, the Gunnell type of system.
Yes, of course.
Five in, five out, right? And we played like that majority of the year until our numbers got to where we couldn't really do it. But that's been my mindset all along, is let it fly. You know, and especially for our skill level, I would much rather a shot be taken than us just turn it over. And so for girls that out of 100 shots, you know, are maybe going to make 15, I still let them shoot it, because if you tell them not to, they're going to think like, well, I can't do that, right? Or he doesn't want me to do that. And then they just start start doubting themselves. Again, you want them to have fun. I'm at a small high school for girls basketball. Majority of my girls will never, ever play basketball again after high school. And so you want them to enjoy it. As a coach, I've definitely learned patience. And that's, I know that's one of your questions you might have coming up, as far as like some things that I've learned. Again, I've been a head coach now only 5 years. The difference between year one and year five, I was 30 years old when I got my first head coaching job. I was all about me, my ego, my bravado of wanting to be like, hey, I'm a young head coach. I know more than you, high school boy. You know, like, that was very much my persona. And I was like that for a couple of years. And I think it really came from my wife, and even like, you know, my interactions with officials, right, came off as that too. Again, a young guy trying to prove himself. I got so many technicals my first couple of years as a head coach, just because, again, I was out trying to prove myself. And so my ego in my head was about as big as it could be. And then really my third year, and we had more success my third year too as a head coach of the boys team. When we went 24-8, we were successful. But my coaching style changed because I realized, hey, this is not working. And it's not working for me either. And so I need to be a little bit more loose. And I am a very laid back off the court. I'm laid back, funny, like to have jokes and have a good time. But my first couple of years of a head coach, I wasn't like that at all. And it reflected in my coaching style, and it wasn't successful. Mm-hmm. And if you would have told me my year one, after year one, that in three more years, you're going to be a girls head coach, I would have said, man, you're crazy. I couldn't handle that. Mm-hmm. But coming here again, it's all about developing your coaching style, your experience. And I'm grateful for being here, because it's made me a better coach, because my patience level has gone up. Mm-hmm. I've relaxed. I feel like the kids see more of who I really am and my personality and how much I care about them and want them to be successful, not just in basketball. And so that's one of the biggest takeaways that I've had. My first 2 years, I was rough. And I feel like I've gotten a lot better since then.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll continue to improve.
Yeah. No, you took the question right from me. Which is perfectly fine about that difference. Yeah. I hear you. I've been that way too. I mean, some of you listening may know, and I started coaching at like 22 years old, and you really feel like you got a lot to prove, no matter when you first start. But I think as you start to mellow out a little bit more, it's just more fun for them and more fun for you, and probably preserves your lifespan a little bit longer, not stressing out and getting all these technicals and everything like that. That's great.
Yeah. Come back to me in a year. probably about to go through the season.
Oh,
about
no.
Yeah. Hopefully, well, I'm still smiling and I'm not, not back to my old ways. And I think now I'll be able to handle it. I don't know if I would have been able to handle that like my first year, right? Walking into this situation I'm in. And I'm a believer, it's all about, there is more in basketball. It's not just about basketball. You know, what kind of experience can you create for your kids? Mm-hmm. What kind of memories do they know you love and care for them? That's what it's really all about, especially in high school.
Yeah, absolutely.
I still talk to I had two coaches in high school. I still talk to them on a pretty regular basis. And I've been out of high school for over 15 years. And so that's the relationships that I hope to cultivate as mm-hmm. a coach. And that's what really matters. It's not the wins or losses.
Absolutely. Awesome. Coach, to wrap up, and this flew by, what is a coaching moment from your coaching career, looking back on it, that you think others who are listening would be able to learn from?
Kind of going in line with what I just talked about. When I first came in as a head coach at my first job, I tried to be this real egotistic, a dictator. There's no other way to say it, right? Like, it's my way, their highway. Mm-hmm. I know that there are some coaches who are like that and it's successful for them. But it was not successful for me. And so it's anytime you go into a coaching job, whether it's your first head coaching job or 10th year, it's just going in and being a little bit more humble and inviting for players. I think about a lot my first group. I had a good relationship with a lot of those kids. I had 8 seniors my first year as a head coach.
Oh, wow.
And so I have a good relationship with a lot of those kids, but there's some that I don't. Mm-hmm. You know, that just we didn't get on the same page. And looking back, it's not their fault. It was me. Right. I probably did not allow them to get close to me like I do now. And mm-hmm. so looking back, you know, it's just all about relationships. And so my biggest takeaway from my coaching is not one specific example or moment. It's more about how I acted my first couple of years as a head coach. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was the way that you're supposed to do it. And I learned after 2 years that it doesn't have to be that way. And I can be more of David Sanders, who I am as an individual person. I don't have to separate that from being a head coach. Mm-hmm. I can be both. I can be relaxed around kids. I can joke around kids. I can have a good time with them, right? I can develop those relationships that are more important than what I'm asking them to do on a basketball court.
Yeah, I think that it's a really fulfilling thing to have that to look back on, you know, after kids leave your program and you can think of the relationships that you still maintain. And I know that it's hard and you kind of lose sight of that in the moment when you're trying to build your program, trying to do basketball. But when you actually do, as you kind of mentioned, keep those relationships and really invest in your players as people, and then you still have that relationship with them and you still keep in touch with them after, to me, that's where the real fulfillment comes in. So I know it can definitely be hard though, especially as you're trying to, you know, just build your program and focus on the basketball part. It's definitely something really good to keep in mind for sure. And to wrap up, Coach, I give every guest what I call kind of my 60-second soapbox. It's a platform for you to kind of get out your final message, your closing idea, just something to leave the listeners with. So you actually did a really eloquent job just now. So, but I'm going to go ahead and give you that 60-second soapbox anyway, Coach. So you can go ahead and take it away.
I think what I came up with was taking chances, you know, on younger coaches. Not only for coaching jobs, but my long-term plan is to be an athletic director one day. Mm. I have a shelf life on my coaching that I know I will get to probably sooner than later. My master's is in sports administration. And so I love, 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 love basketball. I love coaching. I love watching. I love playing. But my long-term plan is to be an AD one day. And I hope that when I'm in that position one day that I give young coaches a chance, because name and resume and experience and all that kind of stuff is important. I think it has a lot of weight and value, but so does giving someone who's eager and hungry and motivated a chance to do that and chance to be successful, and giving them that opportunity and let them go through some growing pains as a young head coach. I think that's important too. So it's just kind of on that soapbox of taking chances on some guys and some ladies that that deserve it and will hopefully work out for you.
Yeah, I really, really well said. You know, getting those coaches a chance, the only way they get experience is if somebody gives them an opportunity. They got to start somewhere. So I think that's really well put, and hopefully those coaches will have athletic directors like you who are willing to take a shot at them and let them grow. I think that would be awesome. Coach, I want to thank you for spending some time talking just kind of about your coaching philosophy, talking about your offense, talking about kind of your coaching journey. We kind of touched on quite a few things there. That hour sort of flew by. So thank you. Good luck as you kind of rebuild next year and then kind of restart the process all over again. Hopefully not too stressful or too many technicals. I'm sure you'll do a great job, Coach. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on. Loved it.
Awesome. And thank you guys so much for listening. This was another edition of Basketball Teacher Podcast. We'll see you guys next time.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the Basketball Teacher Podcast. Make sure to connect with us on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, or reach us directly through email at basketballteacherpodcast@gmail.com. Take care, be safe, and we'll see you next time.